Dr. Karen Viselli from Concord Orthopedics back with us. How are you?
I'm great.
Excellent. Good to have you back. You know, thanks. I was thinking about you because I knew you were coming in this weekend. I better qualify that. I was thinking about you over the weekend. And how difficult your job is, because if somebody comes in with trauma, mm-hmm. I get it. But people are like cars, okay? Because some cars will run 200,000 miles. Yes. Other cars will run 75,000 miles, then have a spate of problems.
Correct.
And you can never predict when they're on the lot which one's gonna.
Yeah.
Because we don't all wear the same, do we? Our shoulders don't wear the same. Our knees don't wear the same.
No. It's actually kind of mind-boggling to me, and I deal with it every day. I mean, I have patients who, you know, for example, I've been treating this guy who's, you know, not even 40 years old and just has terrible shoulder and knee arthritis. And I have patients who will work into their 70s doing construction and they don't get a lick of arthritis anywhere. So, I mean, we don't really necessarily know why. There's definitely a genetic component to it. There's probably a lot of factors that play into it, but it's not just activity. I think people assume, you know, just because you do maybe like a higher demand job or you place more strain on your joints. I mean, yes, those can be risk factors for sure, but that's only one component of why you end up with
problems. But it's not if you eat broccoli and drink lots of milk, your bones will be fine.
No.
There is no if-then scenario with that.
No, I mean, there's some of it, right? So I would say that just to kind of clarify the difference between like your bone quality and arthritis, right? So arthritis has nothing to do with bone quality, has to do with cartilage quality. Mm. So yes, if you have adequate calcium and vitamin D, probably your bones will be healthier than the average person. Arthritis, it is what it is. Like whatever's going to happen to your cartilage is going to happen.
There's nothing I can eat, do to build up my cartilage?
No, not that we know of.
Really?
I mean, you know, there's a lot of books out there on like anti-inflammatory type diets or arthritis diets where you, you know, try to remove things from your system that are thought to promote inflammation, whether it's certain dairy products or gluten or, you know, obviously there's a lot going on with that right now. But it's never been proven that it actually improves cartilage health. It may reduce like inflammatory symptoms that you have, but it's not building you new cartilage in your body.
You can't really replace cartilage, can you?
Well, it's a long answer to a short question, but I mean that's the multi-billion dollar question of curing arthritis, right? I mean, there's labs all across America and the world trying to study it, I'm sure, as we speak, but essentially the answer is no. In younger patients with kind of like isolated cartilage lesions, there are procedures we can do to try to restore cartilage.
Right.
There are things called microfracture surgeries where you can actually kind of poke little holes in the bone to kind of stimulate bone marrow to kind of come in and fill in the defect, almost
makes
like
sense.
A little pothole, trying to fill it up with a little new
That was good. No, that was good.
That's good. Yeah.
We'll stay with the car metaphors.
Exactly.
No, I like this.
Yeah,
that wasn't even on purpose.
Yeah. That was great. The other procedure, we can actually do like cartilage transplant surgeries where you take cartilage from other parts of your knee, for example, or ankle, or really not shoulder, but certain joints.
Does my body know that that's my cartilage as opposed to taking cartilage from you?
Only in that it has better blood supply. So if you're taking cartilage from yourself, the benefit is that you basically take like a little plug. You kind of core out a little plug and you transfer it into a little hole that you make.
Right.
It's called an Oates surgery. And those tend to incorporate pretty quickly because the bone has good blood supply and it's living. Now, there are also procedures where you can take donated cartilage, like cadaver cartilage. Your body won't reject that. It doesn't know, but that's dead tissue, right? It has no blood supply. It has no living cells.
Good point. Okay.
The incorporation can be a little bit different. And the last thing that we can do is you can actually take healthy cartilage from a joint.
Mm-hmm.
You can grow it in a lab. You get the cartilage cells, and then you put those back in. You essentially sew a little patch over the pothole. You inject the cells underneath and wait for them to grow.
What's the period of time that you're growing out of the body?
You know what? I don't know offhand. I think it's a couple months. I mean, it's not that long, so usually somewhere in that range. But they go down to like a lab in Boston to grow. I mean, you know, these procedures are not that common because they're not for typical osteoarthritis, right? Typical osteoarthritis, which is the wear and tear kind, is when your cartilage just diffusely wears away. It's over a large area of involvement. These are for patients who, say you tear your ACL and you knock off one chunk of cartilage.
Right.
Those are the ones we're going after, where 90% of it looks fine. There's just one piece that we have to address. Yeah.
Now, that makes sense. But when you've got it, the other 90% is a train wreck.
Yeah.
There's really not a lot you can do.
So you
do the cortisone shots, you do whatever. It masks the issue but doesn't deal with it.
No, nothing's giving you the cartilage back. So all of those things are just kind of like essentially dancing around, just trying to keep the symptoms down as long as possible until ultimately you might require something more done, which is a little disheartening, I think, especially, I mean, any patient, when you're kind of dealt something that may kind of chronically limit your function, it's not so fun to hear. I have that conversation a lot, but I mean, you'd be surprised what people cope with. I mean, my mind is blown on a regular basis at how active patients can stay, even with really pretty significant arthritis, just by doing good things for themselves, staying active in exercise, trying to keep a healthy body weight. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do to try to minimize those symptoms.
See, when you have arthritis, from what my understanding, the worst thing you can do is just sit in a chair.
Definitely. Yeah. And arthritis patients will say that. Their joints just seize up. So the movement is good. I mean, every joint is bathed in a fluid called synovial fluid. It's like, it's when you see it, it's thick. It's almost like motor oil, kind of. This is the third car analogy.
Big viscosity. So, yeah, no, that's good.
So,
okay.
But it is. That's about the consistency of it. And so when you're just sitting, that fluid's kind of doing nothing, right? When you're up, it's kind of bathing the joint. And so it tends to make the symptoms. I mean, anything in moderation, right? So I tell arthritis patients, you're not going to run a half marathon this weekend, but take a walk, ride a bike, be on an elliptical, swim, you know, lower impact type stuff is really, really good for those joints.
And a good diet?
Oh, yeah, in general, of course.
You know, carrots keep the weight off. And
definitely, because it helps to minimize the
symptoms. Easier said than done, though.
Of course it is, anything. My dentist tells me to floss, and I don't do it, but I try,
No, see, that I do. I don't brush twice a day.
Yeah.
I do once a day, but I get the little picky things.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
like, okay.
Exactly. But I understand. I mean, it's always easy to sit in an office and tell a patient to, you know, exercise more, eat healthier. I understand. It's much easier to speak about than to actually do, but I think some people, too, kind of once you get a diagnosis, no different than if you were newly diagnosed with diabetes or heart disease, maybe it is kind of like a motivation to say, I'm going to take charge of my health and, you know, really try to actively manage this. So some people view it as an opportunity.
Are we, I know we're in the middle of an obesity epidemic.
Right.
Forget the opioids for a minute. Take that out of the equation. Just obesity. Are we healthier as a society? Are we more healthy than we were 50 years ago?
Oh, geez. I don't know. That's a great question.
Because
I guess,
back then, it seemed like we were always doing stuff. We were going places. We were walking.
Yeah.
We were riding. We were doing. We were active.
Right.
We still had obesity, but not to the degree that we have it now.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's like someone with more maybe knowledge in public health would be more, you know, qualified to answer. I mean, I think in general, of course, there's been a lot of positive moves. I'd say in general, we're probably less active as a society. I mean, obviously, certain things have changed. I mean, there's been a lot of advancements in terms of just medicines, but I suppose that if you're just taking a drug to fix the problem, would you classify that as healthier? Or is that just, like you said, kind of, well, maybe we have a better drug for high cholesterol, but it doesn't mean that fewer people have high cholesterol. We're just doing a better job of managing it.
Right. No, but people are typical. Just give me a pill. I got stuff to do.
I know.
And then I'll go back a month.
Yeah.
I'm still going to eat crap.
Yeah.
But give me the pill.
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, you
got
to help yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
I've only been in practice for kind of going on 8 years. And I think, so maybe I haven't seen the change so much. For me, it's kind of always just been this pace of like, people do want just quick results. And I understand that. I'd be the same way. If I had an orthopedic injury, I'd want to be back on a basketball court or back to, you know, doing an outdoor activity or back to building a stone wall in my yard. I mean, it is frustrating to have to wait, but things take time. And I mean, we do our best for sure, but like there's rarely just kind of a magic pill that's just going to make something go. A lot of it, especially in orthopedics, requires work. And I think in a way, that's what's so gratifying about my job is people that I treat tend to be very motivated to try to get better, right? A lot of it is elective things.
True.
You're choosing to have, say, a joint replacement or a meniscus surgery or whatever it is. And I think so people have the motivation to try to push themselves to get back to their usual function.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's tough. I mean, as we live longer, we're just wearing down parts of our body.
Oh, yeah.
You know, more and more.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I was, you know, started with the original question, because now we're saying, oh, we're going to live till 85.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are 70-year-olds that are active. We're moving, we're pumping,
goodness.
We're still going,
yeah.
You know, doing stuff.
Oh, I've
stuff.
Got them all. I mean, I have a woman I can think of offhand who's I've been treating who's 72, still running regularly. And I mean, just unbelievable shape. I mean, and I think your definition, everything kind of has shifted a little bit, right?
Mm.
So you kind of have your mental kind of maybe upper age limit on what you think would be appropriate for surgical management. And that has completely changed for me. Now, that being said, as vibrant as you are or as healthy as you are, certain things will change about your tissue no matter what, right? Your bone density will decline no matter what. For example, your rotator cuff health, it will not be as healthy no matter what. So even if you are just the sharpest, most active 86-year-old out there, your rotator cuff is still 86 years old.
And now what decreases on the rotator cuff?
Usually it's thought to be blood supply. So
is that what it is?
Exactly. So the tissue just becomes more degenerative with
time. So is there anything I can take to increase the blood supply? Or
no, not for nothing. That either. That's another, you know, I always quote Dr. Moran when I'm here, what can I say? But he says getting rotator cuff tears is like getting gray hairs on your head. And it is in a way. If you look at studies that look at the general population over a certain age, there's an extremely high incidence of tears just because of life, just because of like everything else. The majority of those are asymptomatic. Most times people don't necessarily have any pain associated with them. So there are certain conditions that, you know, say you have an individual come to see you who's in their upper 70s and they have a positive MRI finding, like a rotator cuff tear. You don't necessarily need to operate on it just because it's a positive MRI finding. You really got to take a lot of things into account. Could this tear have been there for years? Can we settle this down by other means? Is this just a typical degenerative finding? I mean, if you operated on every positive MRI that you saw, you'd be busy, but you'd have a lot of people with really bad outcomes. So you really have to kind of be mindful of who you're treating and kind of what the underlying issue is.
I know some people who have had the MRI, the rotator cuff procedure at Concord Orthopedics. Love their physician. Hate the procedure. Sleeping in a recliner for 3 weeks, wears thin real quick. The little arm on the shelf thing. it's kind of, and you see people at the grocery store, they're walking around going, oh, rotator cuff. But after a while, you know, 3 weeks, they start the PT process. Then you're back on the good list.
Right.
And there's a time they hate you.
That's true. Yeah, you're not getting cookies on week two for
no.
sure. But I mean, I think like anything else, it's just an example of it takes patience. And I think for me, I mean, at least I'm sure my colleagues all do the same. I really just try to educate people a lot on the front end. I think if you know what to expect, it tends to be smoother than just kind of jumping into it. That's when at least I find my patients are the most kind of disappointed, is they're in a situation where maybe they didn't know what to expect. If you lay it out for them, now granted, patients don't always remember everything that is said in a visit, or you have a way of kind of blocking out the, it's going to be 6 weeks in a sling.
I was going to say, panic
like
does
that
to you, Karen. It blacks things out. Yeah.
But I mean, I think you do your best to try to educate on the front end. I mean, to me, I think that's the key to success with almost any surgery, is just patient education. Because once a patient leaves the OR, of course it's up to me in a sense, but it's really up to them, right? Or their physical therapist. I mean, I only control that one kind of small portion of the outcome. Everything once you leave is patient directed. You got to try, you got to go to therapy, you got to follow precautions. You're not going to succeed just because, you know, even if you do the most perfect job in surgery, I can only get a good outcome for a patient if it's kind of like a shared relationship with them.
You like doing the surgery, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
Now, do you have people that actually make the cut and get it ready for you? So you, when you walk in, you start.
Have those people.
You don't have people. Okay. Well, we don't know. You know, I didn't know if somebody went in, they made the incision. Because I remember my youngest son was born, and the doctor said, here, you get to cut the umbilical cord. I went, ew, what? And I'm like, no, okay, that's what I'm paying you for. And he goes, here. And I went, and I still remember, I'm like, ew.
The feeling of it, right?
Yeah. And I'm like, you do this every day?
No, I mean, I have lots of people that are in surgery. I mean, we have a full team that's there. I have a physician assistant, a PA, who's there to help. And
but I didn't know if they made the cut. They pushed everything back. So all Karen had to come in was go boop, boop, boop.
No,
boop.
I mean, I'm sure there are centers where that happens. Okay. Even in my training, there were some places there you would maybe see that kind of model. I mean, it's fine. That's legal. That's appropriate. I mean, there's certain settings where it is, but not for me. I'm kind of there. Maybe I'm a little bit, I don't know, control person. I just kind of like
to know
what's
going on.
No, I
don't see that with you, Karen, really.
No.
Control?
No, I just, I like things to be the way I like them. Yeah. And I don't know, for me, I just think you kind of enter in a relationship with somebody and they're placing their trust in you when they're, I mean, under anesthesia to take the best possible care of them. I just feel like it's kind of my responsibility to be there.
If you're doing rotator cuff,
yeah.
How do you, it's kind of gross, and I don't mean it sound, but I don't know. You make the cut to get into the rotator. What do you do with the blood? How do you keep it from?
That's a great question. So typical rotator cuff repair is done arthroscopically, right?
Oh, okay.
So like, you know, patients would call it keyhole surgery, you know, sure. Kind of layman's term. So, you know, an average arthroscopic rotator cuff repair might be 4 incisions. They're probably all about a centimeter or a centimeter and a half
That's
in size.
It?
Yeah. So there's not a lot of bleeding from that alone.
Oh, okay.
Now, when you're in the joint, yes, things will bleed.
Yeah.
And the way we manage that is fluid. So basically the camera that goes in delivers fluid into the joint that kind of like distends it, right? So there's saline that's running through the joint the whole case, and there's water kind of running everywhere during the surgery. And so it's kind of like messy, but not in a bloody way. It's just fluid.
Okay.
And so what happens is as that pressure builds up, it will essentially make it so the blood vessels can't overcome that. Does that make sense? So
it does.
During the surgery, we're working with the anesthesiologist to watch the patient's blood pressure to keep it at an appropriate level so that we can manage bleeding, and that's how you do it. It's a similar concept in the abdomen, like if you have laparoscopic surgery, but they use like gas instead of water. So, but it's the same idea.
I make my own. I don't need somebody to bring it by. Wow.
But it works. I mean, usually it's not an issue. Now, an open procedure, say like a shoulder replacement,
right,
is a different situation, right? But for an arthroscopic surgery, that's
typical. That's kind of cool. No, I didn't know that. Did it ever creep you out when you were the cutting and the blood and?
Only once.
Really?
I've seen some fairly gross things.
I would think you would, yeah.
And most of it does not faze me. I've never been fazed, but when I was my intern year of residency, when we kind of do a little of everything, I saw a facelift and I hit the deck. I was on the ground and I will never forget the nurse in the room. This was in my first 6 months, just said to me, "Honey, you're never going to make it in medicine." And I said, "Watch me."
Wow. Wow, the gauntlet was thrown.
That's exactly right. I can't anything with a face or an ear I really struggle with. But other than that, I'm pretty much good.
Wow, that's face.
No, it's something about it. It's so personal and so like, you know, I mean, I think you keep in mind in surgery, when you're operating on any extremity, you're only looking at that small part,
right?
You're not kind of seeing. I mean, I know it sounds strange because, of course, you're thinking of the whole patient, but you're a little removed in a sense of you're just looking at a knee or just looking at a shoulder or a finger or whatever it is. So,
Wow. So what are you doing today? So you got scrubs on?
I've got a variety of things. I'm going to be in the office. I'm going to be in the OR. I've got a little of this and a little of that.
What are you making for dinner?
I don't know.
You cooking?
Salmon, I think. Quinoa salad with carrots in it. That's on the agenda.
Well, there you go. Dr. Karen, just call me Shania. Bocelli? great seeing you, Karen.
Thank you.
Please come back.
I will.
All right.